Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Nick Triplow. Welcome to the show.
Hiya.
I always like, it's a repeat thing, this, where I have a bit of preamble, and then I go hello again on the podcast, like as if we're just meeting. But I understand that's not what we're doing, and the audience often does, and I let them in on the magic. You've wrote a fantastic book called Getting Carter, Ted Lewis and the Birth of Brit Noir, which I thoroughly enjoyed and learnt a ton at the same time, which is always a good one. Before we go into the detail or veer off into subjects relating to film and its relationship to Get Carter, do you want to give like a brief synopsis of how you would describe? I mean, it's self-explanatory in the title, but if you don't know who Ted Lewis is, it could be meaningless. So, do you want to give a brief synopsis to what Getting Carter is for you?
Yeah, I mean, if I just sort of paint you a picture, I sort of wrote a crime novel and was sort of writing other stuff and on that circuit for a while. And I moved to Barton-on-Humber 20 years ago and discovered that this guy, Ted Lewis, who wrote a novel in 1970 called Jack's Return Home that was then adapted as Get Carter, he lived here. He lived in this town that I've moved to. And nobody knew anything about him. There was no blue plaque. There was no recognition. There was no nothing. And I was doing some sort of social history research for another project.
Yeah.
And I kept coming up against these people of a kind of certain generation who said, oh, you want to write about that Ted Lewis? You know, he wrote that film that Michael Caine was in. And so it was partly an accident, but it was partly the fact that when I started doing little events and stuff, I'd try this little game with the audience, just said, has anybody heard of Get Carter? Because you've got all these hands that go up. And then I'd ask, has anybody heard of Ted Lewis? And usually I'd be lucky if there was one, and that had been my mate who I'd gone along with. So he just wasn't known. And I just thought that's not right. You know, that's kind of criminal in its own way. This guy who'd been quite a predominant writer in his time had fallen off the radar pretty much.
Yeah, I don't. You're making me not feel so bad now, because that's exactly, I exactly was that member of the audience who didn't know who you were talking about.
Yeah, and it's. I mean, I suppose the question is, how does that happen? You know, how does somebody who has a career, a reputation, does things, you know, writes stuff, writes for TV, writes for film, writes novels, etc., etc., how do they fall off the radar? How do they become somebody who nobody knows when the film that they're probably most famous for, it's become, I'm not going to use the word iconic because it doesn't really apply, but it is one of those films that clearly, you know, it's part of our shared national culture, that film, those images, some of those lines, which are Lewis's lines. You know, how does the writer just disappear in that way?
Jack. You shouldn't have shown the film to Frank.
I had to. It was the only way I could get at them.
Well, you shouldn't have. Your brother was going to the police.
You shit.
You didn't have the guts to do it yourself, did you?
They killed me.
They killed my brother. He's
dead. I didn't think they'd do it.
How would you have liked it that'd have been your daughter being poked in that film. What would you have done then? Slags like your Sandra can get away with it, can't they? The Doreens of this world can't, can they?
So there was a kind of, you know, partly an intrigue, partly, you know, a bit of a detective story in its own right once I got into it, and partly some sort of early discoveries that just knocked me off my feet, such as the fact that he'd been like the animation cleanup supervisor on the Beatles' Yellow Submarine. So suddenly you've gone from, all right, so we've got Get Carter, we've got Yellow Submarine. Oh, right, and then I find out that he wrote for Doctor Who.
Yeah,
but it was never actually used. And we can come on to that later if you want. So you've got this guy who's kind of zeitgeist hopping through, you know, every 2 or 3 years. He's involved in a project that is, you know, is still relevant to us now as, you know, either readers or watchers of film or just people who appreciate, you know, the last 50 years of. Pop culture.
Reading your book, what I'm able to see is clearly a man that wants it, because obviously he wants to get out of where you know he's the art school escape from,
yeah,
from the working class path to nothing, as it were, which I can fully understand. You know, I grew up in a small town 10 miles north of Manchester, and it was, you know, you spend most of your life from 14 wondering when can you get out. Kind of thing. But when he gets out and when he finally gets into London, it's interesting how he lives outside of London in the sticks. He's sort of, when he's reached that point where you could argue he's got canon behind him and he's working on it, his legacy's ongoing. It wasn't like part of any sort of, it wasn't part of any set, was he? It didn't appear to be from the story you tell of his life.
No, I mean, he finally made it to London in 1961.
Hmm.
He started out working in advertising, doing copywriting and then sort of running accounts and stuff. But his ambition was to always be involved in film.
Hmm.
And for a little town, Barton, and it is a little town, and it was even smaller then before the Humber Bridge, like, joined us to the rest of the planet.
Yeah.
It was really quite cut off and quite isolated. But it had two cinemas. And he'd grown up as a kid, as a complete cinephile. And, you know, you'd get a change of programme in the middle of the week and he'd go and watch each programme change at each cinema every week, religiously. And he'd sit there and watch the film and he'd watch until the credits had finished rolling. And he memorized the credits. He wanted to know what that was about. How did that work? How did you get to make a film? How did you get to tell those stories? So when he came to London, that was the ambition. That was always the ambition.
Mm.
Was to make a film. And he used what he had in terms of his animation skills. Started off working on the Lone Ranger cartoon as a background artist.
When the factories first began to send their pall of smoke over the city, and farmlands of the East offered only the barest living, Americans turned their faces toward the West. They poured into the new territory by the thousands, fording the mighty rivers, climbing the mountains, fighting Indians and outlaws, praying, toiling, dying. It was a hard land, a hostile land. Only the strong survived. A new American breed, the pioneer. In this forge, upon this anvil, was hammered out a man who became a legend. A daring and resourceful man who hated thievery and oppression. His face masked. his true name unknown. With his faithful Indian companion at his side, he thundered across the west on his great white stallion, appearing out of nowhere to strike down injustice and outlawry, and then vanishing as mysteriously as he came. His sign, a silver bullet. His name, the Lone Ranger.
And basically, that when Yellow Submarine happened, that whole crew, pretty much every animator who was then looking for work, kind of got sucked into that production, because it was like, partly because there was money there to begin with,
yeah.
Partly because the timeline was ridiculous to get it finished.
And it was the Beatles.
And it was the Beatles, and yeah. You know, who didn't want to take that on? And the fact that you had some of the best people in the business, people who were kind of groundbreaking in terms of, you know, that the design. But then you sort of speak to them about some of that stuff, and it's like, it was really difficult to animate because it was flat.
Do you think then that one of the sliding doors in the book is the realization that Ted would have wanted to write the script for Get Carter, but in hindsight, Mike and Michael kind of just didn't think to ask him because he never said what do you think happened there? Because that seems a big sliding door moment in terms of that idea of him becoming notorious with this kind of with the film that's got his name on it, and not becoming notorious for having his name on it.
The one of the issues is that if I sort of, when you look at the credits to Get Carter, Ted Lewis is based on the novel by Ted Lewis at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. When you do a side by side reading of the script to Lewis's novel, you can see that there are certain scenes where Mike Hodges has almost kind of beat for beat taken Lewis's scene and dropped it in to the script.
Yeah.
Because he was a that kind of immersed in cinema, Ted wrote quite cinematically, which is one of the things that, you know, kind of sets his writing apart. But when it came to the point at which Michael Klinger had got the money from MGM to make a British gangster film. He'd got possibly the biggest star, certainly in this country, possibly the world,
sure,
to play the lead. And then he'd got a debut feature film director to adapt and direct it. If you look at the kind of risk to return ratio on that, what you couldn't afford to do was then to bring in a novice screenwriter.
Of course, yeah. I forgot you'd said that. Yeah.
And I think, as much as I know Ted would desperately have wanted to have written the script, it would have been a very different script than anybody who's ever tried to adapt their own prose will probably tell you, you know.
Yeah.
Unless you're able to completely take yourself out of it as a writer, it's a really hard thing to do. And I think some of the choices that Mike Hodges made, you know, Ted would never have made in 100 years. And they were, I think, you know, history shows us they were the right choices, you know.
Yeah.
For example, you know, it works. It's brilliant.
But, I was surprised to learn that when that book was published and became the film, that book in of itself was like the arrival of British noir. So there wasn't really a history. There was obviously noir that came out of America, which, you know, the whole Gumshoe, Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, etc. So there wasn't, before Ted Lewis, really, there wasn't that kind of writing coming out of Britain.
No, I mean, there wasn't really a tradition of it.
Hmm.
I mean, that's not to say there weren't novels that had every noir characteristic going, and there were. Gerald Kirsch's The Night in the City, which was filmed. Graham Greene's Brighton Rock
Yes,
but these are kind of novels that were written about, you know, those kind of characters. James Curtis's They Drive by Night, another one. They're great novels, but they were kind of the 30s and 40s, and you know, it didn't develop into a kind of a more formulated tradition in the way that it did in France and the way that it did in America. In America, it's a kind of, you know, it's outlaw fiction, it's pulp novels, it's those kind of, you know, really tough characters and taking on impossible odds and losing 9 times out of 10. In France, it has, I think it takes on a more socio-political kind of aspect of it. With writers like Machette, who kind of used it to pursue like a socialist agenda in crime fiction, but it hadn't really. It didn't have an equal in this country until Lewis wrote Jack's Return Home / Get Carter. Mm. At which point, that fusion between the British social realism, with all of those details, all of that kind of tawdry, that non-metropolitan, small-town Scunthorpe, matches itself with hard-boiled, tough, uncompromising, violent, sexy, you know, down and dirty crime fiction, noir fiction, in such a way that you simply can't see the join. It becomes another thing in and of itself.
Yeah, because I mean, I must admit, I'm reading your book, it wasn't until it got mentioned I completely forgot about the influence on Dead Man's Shoes, for example, Shane Meadows's, which obviously there's a filmmaker who prides himself on keeping it local in terms of the characters and the kind of stories he wants to tell. He's never been interested in the big London, you know, the big London story or whatever. He's always been about finding the characters that he sees in places he's familiar with.
I mean, I think that sort of outsider narrative, you know, the guy who goes home to set something straight, you know, that's not a new story, but to do it in a place, he does it in, I think, Dead Man's Shoes. Is it set in Utoxeter?
Something like, yeah, it's in one of those East Midlands market towns.
And Lewis was writing about Scunthorpe, you know, in North Lincolnshire. It's a steel town. You know, most people probably haven't been there, and it's, you know, been the butt of many a joke. But, you know, it's an edgy little town. It was a steel town where everybody worked in the steel industry. Friday night, you got paid. Friday night, you know, by Monday morning, you had none of it left. And so you had loan sharks in the steelworks. And that's how Jack Carter started out, as an enforcer for a loan shark in the Scunthorpe steelworks.
Mm.
So you've got this kind of like the, you know, perhaps in the same way that David Simon chose Baltimore, not New York, for The Wire.
Yeah.
You know, Ted sort of found a way to make Scunthorpe the kind of the best possible place to set a story, you know, about a guy coming back from London to take revenge for the murder of his brother and possibly the sexual exploitation of his daughter.
I mean, that part of the story, and certainly in the beginning of the film, Get Carter, where you've got the great and the good watching the 16mm camera, dirty films, as it were, with the, which turns out to be obviously underage actors and stuff. It's interesting for him to pick that up, given 40 years later, that was all the news that the great and the good were doing.
Yeah.
You know, there was elements of the great and the good as we saw them who were involved in this kind of exploitation and abuse. And yet it was just like a kind of, almost like in the film, certainly, I've not read the book yet, but in the films, it's like it's obviously coming from somewhere that this is happening, but it's not something that everyone was seemingly conscious of for 4 decades, that this kind of dirty undercurrent existed in Britain.
But I think Lewis worked in Soho right throughout the late 60s.
Mm.
The film's producer was Michael Klinger. Michael Klinger was sort of Soho born and bred.
Yeah.
And he owned review clubs, review bars in Soho, and he owned what were loosely termed continental cinemas. And so he knew that world, and he knew it well enough to know, you know, to kind of guide Mike Hodges in how to make that look the way it should look.
Mm. And given what got you started, this idea of no one's really heard of Ted Lewis, and that was kind of the thing that got you looking, then you start to find out all these great popular cultural touchstones in it. What for you was the biggest surprise in your sort of uncovering of the Ted Lewis story?
I think that given what he did to himself, that he managed to produce as much as he did, given the fact that he was probably almost certainly an alcoholic for the last 10 years of his life.
Yeah.
That the writing that he managed to produce in that time was as good as it was. And you kind of go back and look at like his final novel, GBH, and it's probably one of the greatest British, I was going to say crime novels, but I might even stretch that and say one of the greatest British post-war novels.
Wow.
Based on the fact that it goes to places that I haven't, well, put it this way, there's a scene in there, and there's a build-up of tension in that novel.
Mm.
And when it's released, it floored me the first two or three times that I read it, that he'd actually written what he'd written. And I can't really go into it, and I wouldn't do it because A, it's a spoiler, and B, it's graphic.
Okay. No, I wouldn't. I was going to say, I'll wait for that displeasure when I get there.
But I think, you know, in terms of what surprised me, you know, he came from that generation that, you know, they were drinkers. He was a drinker. I don't think he did a lot of drugs. And that's part of the thing, the Yellow Submarine. Most of the guys were of his generation, and they weren't dropping acid. They weren't, you know, doing magic mushrooms. They were going to the pub and having 3 pints at lunchtime and going back and doing, you know, animation cells.
I'm old enough, but not quite old enough to have experienced liquid lunches. Like, I started work in the late 80s, and you would go out for 2 or 3 pints in the afternoon. I then lost my job to the Great Recession of the early 90s, yeah, and then hid away in university for 3 years. And when I come out by 94, it was over. There was the liquid lunch thing was a real no. I mean, there was obviously a legacy of it that was just dying out. But essentially, you as a new employee, that didn't. And it was very vivid in the book. And I must admit that as I'm reading and discovering Ted Lewis's life and wondering, and obviously having not read his work, thinking I need to get onto this and stuff, and not knowing what the end was, I mean, it becomes obviously apparent almost like a third of the way in that this isn't going to end very well. But it didn't stop me hoping while I was reading. It's funny that, you know, the way you've written it, it's like it didn't stop me hoping that there was going to be something, you know, the next move was going to be the one that'll lift him up. And it was, you know, it's sad that, you know, we get to GBH and the acclaim is happening, but it's kind of so poorly handled as a release. It doesn't matter. Because if nobody can buy it, then it didn't happen. And then
there's a kind of local press interview that he did about the same time as GBH was being published, and you know he thought it was his best work.
Yeah.
But all they wanted to talk about was Get Carved. And you know it is that thing that you know he spent the rest of his life either chasing that kind of recognition that came with it or kind of politely answering questions about Get Carved and when he has another book to publish. Now, you know, he's not the only writer who that's happened to.
Of course.
And he's not the only writer to have had drink problems by a long way. But I think in terms of you kind of look at the arc of his life and how, you know, things sort of fell apart for him, I think, yes, it's sad, it's awful, but he achieved a huge amount in that time. It's just that he wasn't recognised for it in his own time.
especially when you think of people like David Peace and stuff praising him now about how great his work is and how well respected David is, you know, beyond noir fiction in a way, isn't he? I mean, his work's been on Bristol television. People know his work. Obviously, the Damned United was a huge cinematic hit as well as a literary hit as well. It is tinged with sadness, the story of Ted Lewis, not just because of his own self destruction, but for that reason that he never got to feel the appreciation beyond the fact that a dead famous bloke who was got to play the lead in his film, and that helped, and it was done well, and you know, a promising director turned out to be a very good director, so therefore the film was excellent. What do you think it was from your understanding and your appreciation of noir, and for a writer listening into this conversation, what do you think writers could learn from how Ted wrote about the places that he set his and the characters he drew on that made it such good British noir?
I think what he did was, I mean, there is a truth to it. There is an honesty to it. I think there's a fabric to the landscape in this part of the world where you've got the Humber River that kind of divides Yorkshire from Lincolnshire. You've got an industry that's, you know, that at the time he was writing was probably, you know, still thriving in terms of the steel industry on this side of the river. And I think what he was able to do was to take those kind of noir characters, as in, you know, the failures, the people who are, you know, have a moral centre that's sort of movable depending on what they need at any given time, and to write those characters into a place that's recognisable. And I think if you're kind of writing something, I mean, it has to feel real, doesn't it? There's that sort of old adage that, you know, the setting becomes a character in its own right.
Yeah.
He certainly did that with Get Carter, and again with GBH, and arguably with a couple of the other novels as well, where they are absolutely integral. They are part of the conflict. They are the thing that as much as the obstacles that are in the way of, you know, Jack Carter as an anti-hero, as a protagonist, the landscape and his knowledge of it and how it fails him in terms of, you know, the way the drama plays out. And it's knowing your landscape well enough to know how you can use it to your advantage as a writer, and to obviously to the disadvantage of your protagonist.
Is there a distinct difference in your mind? I mean, this is me treating you as an expert, so tell me I'm asking you something that's not so much to answer like, but is there something distinctively different about what you would class as British noir compared to the American noir stuff? In literature, that is, and obviously not the film.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that it's about the weak-minded and the losers and the, you know, the amoral in society, whether it's French, whether it's American.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And whether it's, you know, Jim Thompson, The Killer Inside Me, and Sheriff Lou Ford being completely unhinged and cruel and merciless, or, you know, Jack Carter leaving Alan Armstrong to get the crap kicked out of him, which he knows is going to happen, or, you know, finding himself in a situation where through pretty much his own failure as an uncle or as a father, his niece stroke daughter finds herself in an underage porn film. And that could be anywhere. You know, that doesn't, you know, that's not distinctly British. And, you know, and those are all things that happen in the novel as well as in the film. You know, they're about, like, noir fiction is about the lies we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
And they put characters in front of you and challenge you. So I don't think there's a kind of national boundary to that element of it. And obviously, you know, the streets are different. The landscapes are different. And some of the preoccupations are different. As I said, you know, in France, it can become a lot more political in many ways. And obviously, you've got the vast landscape of America, which means that you can sort of go to a small town in, I don't know where, in Texas, and weird things can happen that the rest of the world has no idea about. Well, you can do that in Scunthorpe as well.
Yeah, I suppose it's the kind of person who can judge their life and their existence on almost like a crapshoot. There's a bad decision and an awful decision, and I'm going to have to take one of them, because to back out would somehow be wrong. To walk away would be worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's about the characters, and it's about the choices the characters make. And in noir fiction, they tend to make really bad choices.
Yeah, because I don't know if you remember, I sent you I did a manifesto based on Paul Schrader's essay on what was film noir. And the one that stood out to me the most is that the journey there, not the what when you get there, is the exciting thing about noir.
Yeah.
So it is all those awful decisions that add up to.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's what distinguished, certainly at the time he was writing it, what distinguished Ted's writing from pretty much every other writer was he wasn't interested in redemption. There are hardly any redeeming characters in a Ted Lewis novel. Nobody is there for a happy ending. And I think that means that the key has to be that you follow this character because of their journey, because of the decisions they make, because, you know, potentially what they're up against is a worse evil than they are, but not much.
Yeah, it's all shades of dark grey.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the reality is that, again, you know, you go back to Jack's return home to Get Carter. He might be sitting in bed crying because he's just seen his girl in a film, but that's the sort of film that he's been selling in London on the streets of Soho for these gangsters, the Fletcher brothers.
Yeah,
you know, that's why he's crying. He's crying because, you know, that's he's carrying that guilt because that's his job. He's probably sold them the film.
Yeah, he's implicated in the crime that's horrified him. Now, one of the things you suggested when we were talking about is looking at some of the films that sort of lead up to Get Carter that you like. Do you want to give a few choice films that people might want to look out for that sort of almost not directly but you could argue plot a route to what is Get Carter?
I mean, I jotted down a list of, I think I've got 6 or 7,
okay,
British films that probably, when you look at them, you look at the kind of progression of British crime fiction and British crime films, because most of these are books. And that was one of the interesting things about writing Ted's story, was I ended up spending an absolute fortune on buying out of print paperbacks for most of these films. So the first one is John Bolting's Brighton Rock, 1947.
Again, who is she? Well, I don't think I'll be needing you after all, Spicy, so we might as well say goodbye.
Well, goodbye, Pinky.
Before you go, I thought you liked to know I'm going to make it up with Colliani.
You are? Well, I'm glad to hear that. Really, I am. Here, now, when you got time, drop us a line, will you? You know where I'm going.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
So, the interesting thing about that is you couldn't have made it before the war, even though the book was written in 1938. The censorship of pre-war scripts in terms of what they would and wouldn't allow probably would have meant that film couldn't be made, because the censors were terrified of the kind of gangsterism in America at the time. that idea that you could have, you know, razor gangs of young thugs and juvenile delinquents in on the streets of London, or, you know, the racetracks of Brighton, simply would have, I'm pretty sure that film would never have been made before the war. So that's the first one. Second one is George Saint's Night in the City.
Out. I beg your pardon.
Out.
What do you mean this is a public place?
So's the morgue. Move.
Well, evidently you don't know who I am.
Mr. Christo don't like club touts hustling suckers in his arena. Get out.
Pigs! Pigs! Pigs!
Gregorius!
Gregorius! Them here! Pigs! Come on!
By that's Gregorius!
Who? Finest wrestler the world's ever known.
Which is a great, I don't know, it doesn't get as much. I don't think it's shown as often as perhaps it should be, but as, I mean, Richard Widmark, he's one of those actors. Lewis loved those kind of actors, like Richard Widmark and Lee Marvin, those sort of offbeat, kind of angry people.
Yeah.
So that would be my second one. Carol Reed's The Third Man.
Victims? Don't be melodramatic. Look down there. Would you really feel any pity if one of those dots stopped moving forever? If I offered you £20,000 for every dot that stopped, would you really, old man, tell me to keep my money? Or would you calculate how many dots you could afford to spend? Free of income tax, only. Free of income tax. The only way you can save money nowadays.
A lot of good your money will do you in jail.
That jail's in another zone. There's no proof against me. Besides you.
Just simply for the atmosphere of it as much as anything else. I don't know. I mean, I know it's setting up in Vienna, isn't it?
But yeah.
Is it a British film? I don't know. Does it?
You would call Lawrence Arabia a British film, so I think you could...
Yeah.
I think we could call Third Man a British film.
The next one is a Robert Hamer film, The Long Memory.
Oh, I don't know that one.
With John Mills. Again, it's another one of these little sort of... It's one of your talking pictures type films. But I think the novel came out, Howard Kuhn's novel came out in 1951 or something, and the film was made in 1953. But it's an incredible... that John Mills comes out of prison for a crime that he didn't commit, a murder that he didn't commit.
Hmm.
And he's living on this barge down in Gravesend on the Medway, and travelling up to try and find out how he got set up and to find the people that set him up. And you've got this incredible, there's a chase scene along the mud flats near Gravesend and Maidstone, which is, you know, there are echoes of that years later in the final scene of Get Past.
Oh, wow.
I've just been talking to Fisher.
He's got the makings of a good newspaper man, that boy.
Fisher oughtn't to be a newspaper man. Not even on this paper.
What's troubling the Craig conscience now?
That you gave him Faye Driver's address and he passed it on to Davidson.
What? Well, he shouldn't have done that. He's got a lot to learn yet, that boy. Oh, what's done's done.
It's not as simple as that. People's lives add up to more than a few lines of print for Sunday reading.
So, but I love it. It's a great film. John Mills is brilliant in it. He's really, you know, not the kind of cheeky chappy with his, you know, sailor suit on in that film. He's a lot earthier and a lot kind of, you know, he's a noir character, really.
Yeah. I'll check that out.
Couple more. Val Guestville, Hell is a City.
DK calling all patrols.
Body of a girl reported 3 miles beyond Crossway's phone box on Doncaster Road. Informant John Hartley waiting at phone.
This is K51 calling M2CK. We are in the immediate vicinity. Proceed to the telephone box and advise an arrival. Over.
Well, a morning, isn't it? Robbery, violence and abduction in Higgins Passage. Now this. Think there's any connection?
Could be. They said a girl.
Right, you police.
Where is it?
Up the road, about 3 miles.
Right, hop in. You show us where and tell us what happened.
It's Stanley Baker. Again, it's based on a novel by an ex-couple called Maurice Proctor, and it's set in Manchester. Although it's not called Manchester, I think it's Grantchester or something in the in the, or Grantchester in the film, but it's Stanley Baker plays this really hacked off copper who's chasing down this bloke on the sort of back streets of Manchester.
Oh, I'm definitely, you might have told for my accent.
I mean, I really recommend it. It's a great film. It's, I think it's an important film as well, partly because it's Manchester. It's not London. And it takes us out of the South, if you like. And Stanley Baker is not a happily married copper. He's a copper who can't get on with his wife, who's finds himself morally compromised, trying to chase down this bloke. And, you know, making the kind of decisions that you were talking about, you know, bad choices and even worse choices. Recommend that. And then Joseph Losey's The Criminal.
Knick knack, paddywhack, get another bone! Knick knack, paddywhack, get another bone! Knick knack, paddywhack, get another bone!
This time tomorrow you'll be out, Johnny.
You know, be in business.
You'll be having a drink. Have one for me. Chatting a girl. Playing the piano. Boogie woogie.
Mac, there's only one thing that worries me about this job.
What's the problem, Johnny?
How many security guards they really have.
It doesn't matter.
It does matter. I can split the difference in your mistakes. I'll get the picture. I can feel it.
Again, Stanley Baker. In fact, these three have all got Stanley Baker in, not surprisingly. The Criminal was 1960, I think.
Those films, those last two, are 1960. So it's interesting. It's a fairly big watershed moment for cinema because you've got Psycho and Peeping Tom that year, haven't you, as well?
Yep. And you've also got that crossover, which I was sort of talking about, that Ted managed to put into literature, that crossover between social realism and the crime story.
Mm.
And it's not really surprising. And I'll tell you the last one on this little list here, which is the Hell Drivers, the Cy Enfield film.
Yes?
I heard you needed ballast drivers.
You met Lagoobin, is that right?
Yeah.
Did he tell you how much he cost us in compensation? He couldn't handle the loads, not at the speeds we wanted. How long have you been driving?
12 years.
Many accidents?
No.
You sure?
No, look, I told you.
License. No endorsements, no convictions for speeding, why not?
I guess I was never caught.
Name and address of your last employer.
I've been out of the country.
Where?
Around.
If you look at, you know, Lucy and Cy Enfield, they were both obviously making films in America, fell foul of the Un-American Activities Committee and were exiled to Britain and to Europe to make films. And so you've got that American influence that's bringing a kind of harder edge to what, you know, before that, a lot of British films have been capers. If you had a working class character, they were going to be a kind of like musical working class character.
Mm.
They weren't real. They didn't feel real. They didn't convince anybody. But then they were usually a cipher anyway. They weren't there because they were sort of a protagonist, or they were moving the plot forward. They were kind of an afterthought. So I think those films particularly, as British films, are important in that lineage of developing a British noir.
Mm.
I mean, I wonder, he probably wouldn't, but I wonder what he'd have made of the character of Jack Carlton.
Because I guess he couldn't, he never got to play such an extreme brute because the times wouldn't have allowed it. And obviously, Get Carter was in of itself a kind of watershed. I think it's really interesting given how much we know, like how the black market functioned during the war. So clearly working class areas were rife with criminal activity, in inverted commas, to sustain itself. And obviously they would have been full of people who are making awful, bad and cruel decisions to make their money. Yet it takes a good 10, 15 years for mainstream fiction to show it, to show that was a, you know, like you said, it was only ever like the cheeky entertainer or the.
Or the yeah, movie. I mean, it's you can't think of many before that sort of late 50s, early 60s.
No.
And there are a handful, as I say, you know, that The Night in the City and The Long Memory are early 50s, and they're worth watching for that reason. Is that you can see that there's a kind of pushing at the boundaries of the way characters are on film. And one of the heroine of the Long Memory is she's an immigrant, a refugee from Europe, and you know there's the acknowledgement that there's actually an underclass.
Mm.
Or that there is a working class, or there are people who are outside of society.
Well, I remember, I mean, this isn't even about noir, but I remember reading an article about the impact of Coronation Street, and there was a show in the early parts of its run where a guy took apart a motorbike in his living room in the two up, two down, and that received a record number of complaints for just simply being uncouth.
There's actually, I've realised I've missed one out on that list, which is quite important, which is The Blue Lamp.
Okay.
1947, 49, with Dirk Bogarde, William Hartnell, and Jack Warner as P.C. Dixon, who would become Dixon of Dock Green.
To this man, until today, the crime wave was nothing but a newspaper headline. What stands between the ordinary public and this outbreak of crime? What protection has the man in the street against this armed threat to his life and property? At the Old Bailey, Mr. Justice Finnimore, in passing sentence for a crime of robbery with violence, gave this plain answer.
This is perhaps another illustration of the disaster caused by insufficient numbers of police. I have no doubt that one of the best preventives of crime is the regular uniform police officer on the beat.
Veterans like George Dixon, 25 years service, now Police Constable 693 attached to Paddington Green.
Excuse me, officer, can you direct me to Paddington Station?
Yes, sir. Straight across the green, turn left over the iron bridge and you're there.
Thank you very much.
Which is significant because that's the first time a police officer has ever been allowed to be shot in a British film.
What, The Blue Lamp is?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Before that, you couldn't kill a copper on a film.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's hard to imagine that being significant, but obviously it had to have happened for the first time once.
Totally.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what a film-going audience, you know, whenever sitting in the cinema would have made where you've got this, and if you watch that film, you know, he's a really sympathetic character. Really sympathetic.
Mm.
And that's where that what I was talking about, that sort of that fear of gangsterism. Mm. Was there before the war, which meant films like that couldn't be made. And that's who Dirk Bogarde is. You know, he was a younger man then, and you know, he epitomizes that sort of, you know, this is how terrible it could become if you've got gun-toting, you know, juvenile delinquents shooting police officers on the streets of London.
A terrifying thought. Let's remind people then, Getting Carter, Ted Lewis and the Birth of Brit Noir is out now through No Exit, isn't it? Yeah.
It is No Exit. Yeah.
Well, before you go, is there anything new you're up to? Anything you can talk about that you want to let us
know? At the moment, I'm sort of writing. Got a couple of things that are out with publishers at the moment, which I'm waiting to hear back about. But just, you know, making sure as many people find out about Ted Lewis as possible at the moment and writing my own stuff and seeing what happens.
Well, the Getting Cat has an excellent job of it because I certainly feel like I've discovered him without having a clue. And I'm someone, you know, I've seen Get Carter 20 plus times and I feel ashamed that I hadn't really paid attention to. I'd focused so much on, because by the time I get around to watching it, it's been out 20 years, you know, so it's always been a Michael Caine film. And everything else is, you know, and it's that idea of it being in Newcastle, and that's got all your attention.
And I think it stays with you kind of watch, I don't know, you watch a film like Mona Lisa, Neil Jordan's film, and you see Michael Caine playing a sleazy pornographer gangster, and you just think, that's the bloke that Jack Carter could have become.
Well, I'm friends. I work with one of the producers of Harry Brown.
Yeah.
And obviously they cast Michael Caine in the lead. And yeah. There was that idea that, you know, you could, if you, you know, and I know the story doesn't tell that story, but in a sense of Michael Caine's career, you could see how that's a continuation of characters he's played. You know?
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? I can't think of another, now Get Carter's 50 this year.
Yeah, amazing.
I can't think of an equivalent British crime or gangster film that still resonates in the way that does. Other than The Long Good Friday. And those two films stand as sort of pillars at either end of the 1970s.
Yeah, because it's interesting. Because it's interesting because in the same year, The Reckoning comes out with Nicole Williamson. And
yeah.
I was surprised to learn about that film recently. Not that it even sort of got any of the recognition. And, you know, Nicole Williamson is a brilliant actor.
Absolutely fantastic, yeah.
And, you know, there's a man goes back to Liverpool to sort out a wrong to the family and everything. So the you know, story wise, there's certainly an echo and a similarity, but one captured the British public's imagination and one didn't.
And you know, within about 2 months of Get Carter being released in 1971, the Richard Burton film Villain was released as well. And so there was a little kind of pocket of filmmakers who had obviously, you know, that's what was happening. That's what was in the news. Those kind of Richardsons and McCrays and they're kind of, those criminal empires were being exposed for what they were. So, you know, at last you had a homegrown story that could find its way onto the screen.
And you also had a kind of dearth of actors who'd sort of cut their chops in the 60s and were ready for these more challenging roles in more challenging films, as it were.
I mean, I've watched it on a film print, on a 35mm film print, a couple of times, Get Carter, and I don't know. Is this controversial? I don't think Michael Caine has ever been better.
It's a good argument to say that he hasn't. I don't know. I'm sure he would hope he has, because there's a lot of acting.
Yeah, and I'm sure he would. But I've watched it and I just think, you know, he's such a good performer.
Yeah,
it's so solid, and he's got a supporting cast who are well capable of coming up against them, Ian Hendry and John Osborne. You know, they're not lightweight actors in their own right.
Mm. No, I mean, and for me, some of the best moments in the film are where there's sort of the least happening. So, but it's all about the mood. It's where he goes into the bar and just orders half a pint. And he just sat at the bar, sensing that all eyes are on him. And that's not an easy thing, you know. I'm no actor, but I can imagine it's quite hard to play being a bit paranoid.
Yeah,
you know. But you feel watching that scene that he feels he's got the whole eyes on him for the bar. It's I agree. It's a phenomenal performance.
And it runs through, and it's there. It's there in Lewis's novel. I mean, you know, that's Lewis knew those people.
Mm.
To what extent, you know, is his own sort of conjecture, but he definitely hung out in that part of London at that time in the late 60s, where they were around. Michael Caine knew them, you know, to a certain extent. And so they were kind of coming from a point of experience and of knowledge and of, right, this is what we're doing. So I think when they came together with Michael Caine, Lewis's story, Mike Hodges, as a feature film director with form for doing crime drama, and Michael Klinger as a producer who'd got the MGM money for a short period, an independent producer who'd come from that world himself. It's, you know, that's, and I guess you'd have to say Wolfgang Schizitzky's cinematography, which is awesome in genuine sense of the word. And, you know, it's, that's why it works. That cast, that writing, those people involved.
Well, look,
brilliant.
Thank you for pulling the curtain back on Ted Lewis to let us have a look. It's a fantastic read. I recommend it to anyone with an interest in and around Get Carter and in British noir fiction. It's excellent. And also as a kind of potted history of popular culture, I mean, just as a, we don't have to talk about it, but just as an aside, you know, even like the jazz scene of you know, Yorkshire Humberside, it's like, that's not something I was familiar with, but that seemed like a gateway to where he ended up, you know. So, and that's a lot of people can relate to that. That's that discovery of this otherness that exists outside your street. And it doesn't have, you don't have to go a million miles for it. And that seemed really, that was a necessary part of the tale. And it was an interesting insight because you know, as a kind of grown up around Manchester, living in London for 20 years, going to university in Birmingham, I kind of have a perception of other parts of Britain, which is not that culturally dense. Yeah. But the idea that there was this ripe jazz scene, you know, it was a real surprise. So, you know, those kind of things are, it's always, social history of Britain is always much better when it's pointed at specific areas. And I applaud you for that. So just because we say thank you very much for giving your time on the Britflix podcast.
That'd be great. You're welcome.
The wife says that the Fletcher sent you. What's so bloody important he couldn't wait until the morning? Listen, I'm not in the mood for playing silly buggers. I made a mistake.
What?
I made a mistake. What about?
Never mind.
It's not business.
See you.
Listen, I don't like it when some tough nut comes pushing his way in and out of my house in the middle of the night. Bloody well tell me who sent you.
You're a big man, but you're in bad shape. With me, it's a full-time job. Now behave yourself. Right? Good night, Mrs. Bramby.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.